What's up, Dune fans? Welcome back to the Do Not Enter podcast, where today Paul vows to reclaim his right to spice. I'm your host, Humphrey Hsu, and joining me are my friends and co-hosts, Fillmore John.
What's up, guys?
And Nolan Zhang.
Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back, everyone. Today we are going over chapter 44 of Dune, so we're slowly making our way through the book. And this is quite the triumphant and exciting chapter, so I'm really excited to dive into it. But before we do that, how have y'all's lives been? Anything to update us on?
Today this girl drew all over my arm, and like I hope to wash it off because tomorrow if someone sees it on me, it's gonna be really scary. And I better get off before Tuesday when I go meet a bunch of professional working adults, because I'd look really awkward if I'm staring at the drawings on my arm.
Did she draw it in like Sharpie or something? I don't know if you can wash
it. Drew it in like pen. It kind of hurt. Like, I didn't expect it to hurt because, like, I don't know. I might just be sensitive, like, on my
underarm. Why was she doing that?
She's tattooing you.
Yeah.
I didn't know you were like that, Nolan. Yeah.
No.
She just like draw some flowers or something, or.
She drew a tiger, and then I asked for a crane, and then she drew an actual, like, not animal crane, and I was like, bruh.
Oh my.
Oh, okay. Like the construction crane.
Yeah, I was bruh, what?
That's hilarious. Way to take things, I don't know, in a different light, I suppose.
Yep.
Wow, well, that's hilarious.
Quite the interesting week.
Yeah, I hope that was fun. Even, albeit painful. Yeah.
I mean, for my week, I was mostly sick, so I couldn't really do much.
Wow. Shoot, hope you're feeling better now.
Yeah, I'm good enough for this episode today, so I'm here.
Yeah, that's true. All our immune systems are down a bit because it is allergy season. You know, it's always the worst when you go outside and you look on your car and it's like, you know, I don't recall buying a yellow car. You know, it's just spotted yellow, and you're like, and your nose just starts itching, your eyes just start watering. You know, it's not.
Yeah, it's literal biological warfare.
Honestly.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. But that's never fun. So, I mean, it makes sense that you got sick early into the allergy season, but.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah, immune systems, but busy fighting non-existent threats.
Yep.
All right, cool. Well, pretty interesting weeks, but we have an interesting epigraph. So, Nolan, why don't you take it away with the epigraph?
Okay, so this week's epigraph reads, "How often is it that the angry man rages denial of what his inner self is telling him? The collective sayings of Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan." So, this week's epigraph is actually really short, and the thing is, it's still profound, though. It discusses the tumultuous internal conflict in oneself. So when a person cannot handle the truth that their inner self is trying to tell them, they rage hard in constant denial of themselves. So many of us may scoff at this because we're like, of course we accept the truth. Or like, of course, like, we listen to ourselves. But the truth is, we have a lot of moments where we lie to ourselves. You know, we block out our emotions, we block out our thoughts because we can't handle what we're thinking, right? Because we can't seem to accept the unchangeable aspects that, like, we just can't stop, like, feeling or thinking. Honestly, I really agree with Paul, and I think these are really wise words by the Muad'Dib.
Right. Honestly, it's like, if you were to see a real-life UFO and it showed up in front of us, you still wouldn't believe it, because you would think it's fake or some sort of supernatural event that's not a UFO. You just think it's the government interfering with your mind or something. I don't know. Something that makes more sense than what the real thing is. So it's sort of a coping mechanism.
You draw your own conclusions. You try to make it logical, but like, it's just not.
Yeah, whatever it's illogical.
Yeah, right. And especially anger really impedes your faculties of making decisions and believing in yourself. You know, you start questioning and doubting a lot more. And so that's just not, you know, even when the facts are evident, or, you know, you can see a lot of evidence for some specific phenomenons, you know, you just won't believe it due to being blinded sort of by that anger. Yeah. So, yeah, really cool. Short and sweet epigraph. Thank you for that. And before we go into the chapter, we have a few quotes. So, Fillmore, as usual, you have the first quote.
Okay. So for my quote this week, I chose, "Do you think me stupid? Do you think I'll cut off my right arm and leave it bloody on the floor of this cavern just to provide you with a circus?"
Wow.
Yes, just kidding.
Really? We'll see about that.
You're not just a clown. You are the whole circus.
Yeah, I love using that. That's one of my favorite roasts.
Yeah.
My quote goes, all men beneath your position covet your station. So not really referencing vicious. Anyone in particular, but, you know, we'll see how that applies in general.
My quote this week goes, they could not be more ready. We are taking them at the crest.
Wow. You know, it's at the
surfing
peak.
Today.
Yeah, I was thinking that. I always just imagined that, you know. Even when we're talking about like crest or something of waves or whatever, you know, like in like physics class or whatever, I always just think of surfing.
Well, those surfer dudes must be really good at physics there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, they can calculate the exact trajectories in their head. Yeah. Cool. All right. Great quotes. And let's dive right into the chapter then. So we return to Jessica's point of view for this chapter. And she's just recently traveled up to Paul from the south, as Paul requested. You know, we were referencing at the last episode how Paul still wanted Jessica's advice. So it's been a few days or weeks, I guess, since the events of the last chapter. Paul is not letting Jessica use the ornithopters yet. So, you know, she had to have quite the tiring journey instead of a comfortable flight, right? Rather, Paul is trying to preserve the materials and tools for times when they'll really need it. So he's, I guess, you know, he's saving money on gas because it's definitely expensive in Arrakis.
Mm-hmm. I like the way he phrased it. Both fuel and aircraft must be gathered and saved for the day of maximum effort. It honestly sounds like they have a D-Day Normandy invasion plan ready to go.
Yeah, that's what I was imagining too. It's just one day and then boom.
I also really like just how thought out Paul's response is, because while Jessica wants to be like Joel Osteen traveling with his multiple helicopters and private jet, Paul is like thinking much more logically about fuel dependency and like the fear of it. Because historically, at least in our world, we've seen that many countries have gone to great lengths, even to war, to try to protect their fuel dependency or like to try to acquire more like fuel.
Yeah, it's the US is a prime example of that.
It really is. Yeah, so going off of what you were talking about of the day of maximum effort, so does it really mean that they're building for an all-out attack against the Harkonnens? I mean, it's been hinted at, but now, you know, here's the most explicit evidence that we have so far. And I think it's just pretty crazy given that the Fremen are, you know, they're not very coherent. They call them, you know, sieges and tribes and stuff. So they have, they're not all just one unified body. They're split into a lot of different factions, at least from what I can tell. And they're really spread out too, so it's not just something they can easily amass a large force. And lastly, they don't have the sheer resources to match the Harkonnens. The Harkonnens have lasguns and shields, and you know what, the Fremen, of course, they have really
their own ships too.
And ships and everything. I mean, they can just take out the Fremen from all directions. And while the Fremen, you know, have this amazing stillsuit technology, and you know, they have a lot of other technology, and of course, they're really qualified fighters. They can fight off Sardaukar. It's just, you know, I can't really believe at this stage that they're going to be able to successfully fight off the Harkonnens.
Well, I still think that there will be a day of where they pull an all-out attack. And the thing is, they do have the element of surprise. Well, maybe not anymore because Paul kind of gave it away, but they won't know when they're going to launch the attack. So I guess they still do have the element of surprise. But even so, like, even though they don't have the resources, maybe, nor the troops to match the Harkonnens, they're still going to launch an attack. And I'm assuming it's going to be successful because it's going to be a battle of quality versus quantity. And we know that quality is more important when it comes down to a fight. Mm-hmm. But there have been moments in history where certain elite forces were wiped out just by the sheer quantity of numbers. So I guess we can't completely discount the Harkonnens, but I still think the Fremen are going to come out on top.
Definitely, I think really Paul has to go for something sneaky, fast, and game-changing, to be honest. You have to choose a battleground really carefully in the battlefield itself to capitalize on the Fremen's obviously very talented battling abilities, enhanced by Paul and Jessica's weirding ways. But he has, at the same time, he has to mitigate them being outnumbered and basically being outmatched in the air. So they have to choose some time where like it has to be them on Arrakis, but at the same time, they have to strike a target that's high up on the ladder enough to make the entire like Harkonnen system stop. So they have to kind of draw the Harkonnens onto Arrakis, into them. So it just has to be well thought out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, so can't really go in without a plan. But I mean, they might have the plan right now. They don't have the resources.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, you know, Jessica also mentions that Paul hasn't shown her Gurney, right? Paul hasn't pulled out Gurney. And Jessica also yeah. wonders why that is. And, you know, and it's just kind of ironic because Jessica really has no idea what Gurney has in store for her. She has no idea that, you know, most of the surviving Atreides all think that she is the betrayer. You know, it just, you know, without all this information, that wouldn't even pop into her mind, right? So so I just think that's really interesting. I still can't wait to see how Gurney reacts to seeing Jessica for the first time. Will he just leap at her? Will he, you know, fire a tranquilizer dart? We don't know. But but anyway, Jessica also refers to Leto as Paul's father, just something I noticed. And the first time I read that, I had to reread it because it's kind of an apathetic way to refer to your former partner. Maybe she's just really distancing herself. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe it's a coping mechanism, although it could just be that Herbert wrote it that way because he has a specific style of writing and he just didn't want to use the word husband.
Maybe. Yeah, for me, I'm also just more surprised that Jessica kind of like knows about Gurney being back because Paul hasn't told her so I don't know. I guess she does have her spy network, but it's just like, it's kind of awkward a situation between Paul and Jessica. Usually it's like, oh wow, like an old friend is alive, like you want to tell everyone, especially those who knew him in the past, you know. So it's just kind of a little awkward between Jessica being like, I know he's alive, Paul, like why haven't you introduced him back, you know, back into our old lives yet? But I think also though, just like part of the reason why maybe Paul hasn't done it yet is because maybe it's for the best for Jessica, because like I've been mentioning, she's kind of right now apathetic to like the past. She's trying really hard to stamp down her feelings. So I think it's because like Jessica hasn't quite come to terms with all the old memories and like the feelings that she had, like a better, more relaxed days on Caladan. So she's just like, if too much of it is fed to her, she might cry, like break down, I guess.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's sort of overwhelming, I guess. Kind of lasting trauma, I suppose, from that attack.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. The homesickness is getting to her.
Mm-hmm. It really is.
Honestly.
Yeah, but apart from this kind of internal tension that Jessica has, there's physical and, you know, you can feel the tension in the room here. Quite literally. Yeah. Stilgar's life is at stake, and it seems Paul has concocted a detailed plan here about how he's going to convince the Fremen, and we'll have to read on just a few more pages to find out what that is. And the fact that these young men, though, have such a religious fervor surrounding Paul, they don't even, you know, they don't even want his position. They just want to support him. And this is just, you know, this just doesn't bode well from what we know about the jihad and everything.
Yeah, honestly, the type of like unquestionable loyalty they have does worry me as well. But at the same time, at least we see that Paul himself, though he sees that a lot of people have faith in him, doesn't quite like still chooses his actions really carefully. So it does seem like last chapter, Paul mentioned that he's going to have a meeting with Jessica to discuss some stuff about the whole Stilgar power inheritance thing. And we see that at the beginning of this chapter, he's already had this meeting with Jessica, and Jessica was able to provide him some type of wise counsel and confirm Paul's judgment. We don't know quite what it is yet, but we do see that Paul still does turn to advisors, even if that's like his mom, you know.
Mm-hmm. So going back to the religious fervor that you mentioned, so they mentioned in the chapter that there is no covetousness, which means that there is no envy. So that means all of them truly want Paul to be their leader in both in name and status. And as you mentioned, this does not bode well because it can act as a double-edged blade. So the fervor keeps traitors from appearing. However, it also means that the actions they commit will not be rational and instead emotional. And this will eventually bring them down a path of destruction.
Yeah, just not thinking straight when like it comes down to religious fervor, honestly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so especially, you know, religion-wise, there's two Bene Gesserit axioms that we must discuss here that are mentioned. And I always love seeing Bene Gesserit axioms because they're always so fun to discuss. They always hold, you know, bits of truth to them that are just really fun to pick apart. So the first one, which is also my quote for the week, it goes, "All men beneath your position covet your station. So this is, you know, really interesting because it's like a natural human inclination or food chain kind of thing, I guess, with the greed that is natural and innate to humans. We're rarely satisfied with what we have, and we would rather take a higher social material status than what we're
always
have
comparing.
Currently. Yeah, always directly comparing, whether it's others comparing you, you compare yourself to others, or you comparing yourself to yourself, even, you know, people are trying to achieve something better. And I'm not saying that everybody always has to push to the top or always has to push themselves, but it's just that in this lesser civilized Fremen society, it seems to be a lot more hierarchical. And it just seems to be the case that people would like to take leadership, right? And they would, if they feel that they're in a position to challenge, it just seems that they would rather do that. And I mean, personally, I know that I'm always trying to be better than other people at things they're good at, and even, you know, when I don't have any business being better than them, or, you know, because, maybe because it's something that's kind of irrelevant to me or something that I'll just never be good enough for, right? So I mean, somehow in society, though, people are just really upward looking. People are always looking to punch up, right? Kind of in these cases.
I think it's good to have healthy competition, because I also like honestly, I also like seeing other people being good at stuff and then me trying things out. Maybe not for me to like surpass them, but me just to be able to like learn something from them and just to get decent at what they're good at.
Yeah, I think competition is very important, but with healthy competition does come with unhealthy competition. And
Toxic.
Let's be honest here. Most cases are some forms of toxic competition. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of sportsmanship and whatnot is kind of dead nowadays. Like, there's always trash talk and whatnot.
Yeah, but, and it's always people who are better than you aren't trying to help the people that are worse than them. It's always
because they're sort of gatekeeping.
It's a heavy gatekeep, and a lot of times it's like a psychological gatekeep, much like not like a physical gatekeep, but it's just making people below them feel that they're not good enough, right? But I mean, we're straying kind of far from the topic, but it just kind of goes to show that in this Fremen culture, they're always looking to, you know, kill those who are in charge. Well, they're not doing that always, right? But whenever some person feels that they've amassed enough power or they've gained enough supporters to be able to challenge those in charge, it's kind of expected that they will. So especially the events of this chapter will shock quite a few Fremen who are very traditional. Cool. Yeah, so that's the first axiom. The second axiom goes, prophets have a way of dying by violence.
Ooh. So about this second quote on prophets, we do know that Dune does make a lot of allusions to the Abrahamic religions, and each, of course, have their own different prophets because they're their own different religions. And so for Christianity, the main prophet is Jesus. For Islam, is the prophet Muhammad. And for Judaism, is the prophet Abraham. And while I would like to cover all three different religions, I don't quite feel, I guess, comfortable going over all three, as I'm not an active participant. And I feel like getting it wrong would be much more insulting than like getting it half right. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I'll only speak for Christianity, as I am a Christian. I can confirm that Jesus did die a painful death on the cross. But y'all probably do know that part. But another part that y'all may or may not know is that he was betrayed by someone very close to him. He was betrayed by one of the 12 disciples. And he was rejected by the very people that he came to save, the Jewish people. So a couple of days before the Passover, he entered Jerusalem. He was accepted. He was welcomed with like palms. Say, like, everyone waved their palms. They laid down their palms in front of the donkey that he was sitting on. So, like, he walked across the palms. And then just a couple of days later, he was put on the cross, booed by the people, and asked to die. So at least on Jesus's end, he met a pretty gruesome death by his own people. And that's what I think is like what Herbert's trying to get here. There's like this gruesome way that prophets have a way of dying in. Because as a prophet, or anything, well, like, just when anything gets religious, it gets pretty dangerous because people start thinking less with their brains and more with how they feel, their emotions, their hearts, which gets pretty scary pretty fast sometimes, depending on how radical people are.
Yeah, and it just reminds me of some Greek mythologies too. You know, a lot of different prophets, because they're bringing, you know, terrible tidings of or some sort like that. You know, it just reminds me of Oedipus and that prophet. Ooh, I forgot his. It starts with T. I forgot. Like, it's T-I something. I can't remember. I mean, Tiresias, that's what it was. I mean, Tiresias did die a painful death, but definitely he was shunned and ridiculed by Oedipus for bringing this, you know, news that, you know, Oedipus and Oedipus's wife was his mother, right? So that was a kind of another example, and I'm sure there's worse instances maybe in Greek or Roman mythology that just, you know, where the prophet was just murdered straight up for delivering something that the king didn't want to hear, but was ultimately true. So, you know, because a lot of the times there's no need for a prophet to deliver good tidings. So all of the bad tidings that come just, you know, make them that much easier to kill by those people in power, right?
Yeah, they're always shooting the messenger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Always shooting the messenger. That's how it is.
Hate the message, not the messenger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah, two really cool axioms in my opinion, some of the cooler Bene Gesserit ones, but always looking forward to seeing those in chapters.
Yep.
So moving on from that, Paul begins this huge speech to the Fremen, which is kind of the majority of this chapter. So it's another huge congregation here.
We also see that this congregation was collected for two main reasons. Firstly, it was to announce the Fremen's next objective in exploiting a moment of weakness on a Harkonnen's end. And secondly, it was so that Paul can settle things once and for all when it comes to Stilgar in front of the Fremen people.
Right, yeah. So going off with what you said first, Paul has intercepted a Harkonnen courier, and now he knows of the Baron's master plan to make Raban drive the Grabensinken Pan Arrakis natives to death while they're hunting for and manufacturing the spice. And this way, the people will readily accept Fade Rautha as their savior. Of course, Paul doesn't know that this is the Baron's plan. Paul just believes that the Baron has made a massive oversight. But either way, I think the effect and the outcome will be the same. And especially the Baron doesn't anticipate that Raban will be overthrown because, you know, he's just
right. He doesn't expect the Fremen.
A really tiny fact here that the Fremen can fight. You know, they're not just mindless animals. And this could really complicate things, even though Raban is really in like a lame duck period of his reign, considering Fade Rautha is about to step in and take over. If the Fremen could make a show of power here and seize the available resources that are still on Arrakis, they could multiply their powers by a significant margin.
Yeah, they could potentially become their own rulers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course, and of course the Harkonnens would not stomach that, and they'd come and try to take it back. But you know, then any little bit would help.
Yep.
And Paul also has totally absorbed his role as the Lysan Algaeb. So I think he's invoking this religious mantle almost against his will. Because from what we know about Paul, there's no way he'd do this out of his own will, right? Unless greater circumstances called for it. Because he must know that driving these super religious, fanatical, you know, almost insane Fremen, if he drives them on with all this talk of Lysan Algaeb and Mahdi and all of that, this will all just lead towards the jihad every single step, right? And as a future seer, he should be able to. He knows that, I would say, but there's not much else here he can do other than assert his own strength and power from the onset by quoting that he's the Lysan Algaeb, and that way it immediately seizes his crowd's attention, because that's really what he needs right now.
Right, he didn't really have a choice. He had to invoke the name in order to get them to listen to him, because at this point there isn't really any other way for him to get their attention but except to take on the mantle and become their leader. Except,
yeah,
like it's his actions from here that really decide the future.
He's in a really rocky spot with the Fremen because they're mad at him because he's taking so long. So he kind of needs to remind them that, like, who he is to them, even if that means going against what he wanted. And he needs the power of the Lysan Algaeb, like the whole religious aspect, to provide some legitimacy to like explaining him, like to getting them to hear him out in the first place. He needs them to give him a chance.
Mm-hmm. And then there's this part where Paul says, "You will say," he agreed, "but first you will hear my say." And I thought this part was so epic.
I know.
Because like all the Fremen are just crowding around him, and he's looking down on them, on this big crowd of young, bloodthirsty Fremen. And he's just there asserting his dominance. And even with his power of the voice, he used it to get the Fremen to quiet down. I don't think it takes away from the moment at all.
It kind of reminds me of when people say, like, "I agree to disagree." I kind of hate it, but it's like, yeah, I hear what you're saying, but like, shh, I still think what I have to say matters more, regardless of what you just think, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I must say I use, let's agree to disagree, I use that a lot. Mostly because I'm I'm really not that confrontational, and half the time I'm just, yeah, too lazy to argue. So yeah, let's just agree to disagree.
Yeah, and half the time they just have bad takes and I just don't want to deal with them.
Exactly. That's the other half. That's so fair. Yeah, that's the politically incorrect half of my opinion. But but you're right though. It wouldn't really be debate if it was just one party talking. So Paul, no matter what, he has to present his opinion, and Stilgar backs him up by saying every Fremen is allowed to present his opinion in council, right? So, I'm glad they have that element of democracy going.
Mm-hmm. And then now we finally get to the part where Paul addresses the issue of calling Stilgar out. And I really like the metaphor he uses. Do you smash your knife before a battle? And I think his comparison of Stilgar to their Chris knives was smart, because I think it would further draw their attention in and make them understand what he says next.
Mm-hmm. I think the analogy to the knife really did make sense to me as well. It was definitely a lot better than the paragraphs earlier where Paul is trying to explain to the Fremen how the separation of powers works. And even for me, like, who does know how separation of powers works because we have it in our own US government, it was really confusing. Of course, like, a lecture on government isn't exactly inspirational or emotionally evoking. So, of course, Paul just spiced it up with, like, adding in, like, applicability in their world. But for me, it was definitely really hard to follow the entire time. It was probably one of the reasons why Jessica was like, this is a dangerous way to do it. Because she was like, they're not following.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's a more Fremen way of saying, I guess, you know, would I cut off my right hand? All right, it's a more Fremen way. Mm-hmm. Would I smash my knife before a fight? And it's just something that they can more easily comprehend. And I'm just kind of surprised that Paul is almost dumbing down a lot of things. I hesitate to say that, but it kind of is like that. He's dumbing it down for the Fremen because they'll blindly follow all of this religious stuff. They'll blindly follow what Paul has to say once Paul gains their trust, right? So,
maybe it's not dumbing down, but more just like putting it in the correct context, because like the Fremen don't quite really know our like government system, so he's just like drawing an analogy, he's like conceptualizing it for them. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I can see that.
Also, like my favorite moment on this entire page 429 in our book, is that like Paul pulls out his father's ducal signet from like his necklace, right, and says, I swore never to wear it again unless I was ready to lead my troops over all Arrakis and claim it as my rightful fief. Then follows it immediately up by sliding a ring onto his finger. I was like, boom! And he clenches his fist for the entire congregation to see. I was like, wow, such dramatic impact.
I mean, I don't know why I imagine like anime or something when I think of these things, even though I'm not even an anime enthusiast. It's just so overly dramatic for a proclamation.
I swore never to wear it again. Yeah.
I mean, it's just, I could just imagine, you know, he puts on the ring and then suddenly there's like a bunch of light shining from it and the rest of the background is totally dark and he's just screaming, I roll here, I roll on every square inch of Arrakis. And
yeah,
you know, I mean, I'll stop with this analogy before I make more of a fool of myself. But, I mean, this comedic irony is just hilarious. It's just so overwrought, in my opinion. Paul is just so full of himself, and I get that he's trying to portray this confident image for the Fremen, but I mean as a reader, I find it hilarious.
Me too.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of inspirational at the same time though. Like, it's like this fool that's so confident in himself, but at the same time we're all fools because we're all following him, and that makes us a just cause.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. And so now we get to my quote for this week, and it is, do you think me stupid? Do you think I'll cut off my right arm and leave it bloody on the floor of this cavern just to provide you with a circus? And I think this was the main moment where he convinced the majority of the Fremen that killing Stilgar was unnecessary. Because even with the voice, he won't be able to sway them to his side because of their insulation to voice control or vocal control. But with this one line of logic, he was able to make them understand why calling out Stilgar was unnecessary.
Mm-hmm. I think for me, though, like, I would have preferred it almost if Herbert didn't quite mention Paul using the voice in this scenario, because it was a really moving speech and like it was really touching. And there was a bunch of like dramatic irony and like just like funny moments in it for me. It would just been really cool if like he kind of left out the fact that like the awesome speech wasn't kind of undercut by the manipulative power of like the voice insinuating over the Fremen almost. For me, it was just more comical when Stilgar stirred and looked up at Paul questioningly after Paul asking, "Must I prove it by leaving every Fremen tribe in the Urg without a leader?" Just like stuff like that. Like to me, that just feels much more natural, much more real, like much more like.
So it doesn't look scripted engaging. All the way. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I wish he would have implied it instead of actually straight up writing it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I was really hoping that he'd be like, you know, Paul was using the voice on the Fremen trying to like make them listen to him.
Maybe his voice was tinged with an unnatural element to it or something like that.
Yeah, that would have added to the drama, I feel like.
Because it's caring, commanding voice.
And you're more in the moment in that case, you know. You're not just, oh yeah, Paul is using this voice thing that we know too much about and the Fremen know nothing about, right? It's just uh-huh. You know, it's more that we're in the Fremen's shoes and we can kind of imagine ourselves in that situation, just, you know, listening to Paul and just being wowed by this presence, right? And so, I mean, not that we're qualified at all to critique Herber as an author, but
that's true.
But it's just,
yeah, it's just our opinion.
Yeah, something that we noticed. Yeah.
Okay. And near the end of Paul's speech, he turns the focus of the Fremen's bloodthirstiness towards the Harkonnens by saying, "It is time we stopped killing off our best men and started killing our real enemies, the Harkonnens." And of course, Stilgar doesn't miss this chance and adds fuel to the fire by yelling, "Long live Duke Paul Muad'Dib!" And the result of this was a deafening roar filling the cavern. And I thought this scene was absolute hype because even I was getting excited from his speech, even though I'm not even a Fremen. And
yeah,
honestly, this is probably my favorite scene from this chapter so far.
Yeah, I mean, that's just really, it's just, I mean, even though something feels really wrong about this moment. I mean, it's just the Fremen are so subservient to Paul's beliefs, right? You feel that there's something that's gonna happen, but it's just sort of relieving that there's not gonna be an uprising. Like, it's sort of bitterly triumphant in a sense. So I mean, something just feels off, but also it's just everything feels right.
Yeah, it's so right but so wrong.
Indeed. Duality. Yeah. So the Fremen here are cheering, and I'll try to pronounce this the best that I can. Yahya Tsuhara. So it's kind of derived from Arabic, and I pronounced that off the only pronunciation guide I could find on the internet for this exact phrase. So feel free to correct me if you know better.
Hey, better than me.
Well, I mean, if I studied it, I'd hope so, right? Which Jessica translates this Yahya Tsuhara to "Long live the fighters of Muad'Dib." So really interesting phrase. But however, you know, the Yahya is really just one word. So Herber writes it as two words, Yah space Hya, but it's actually just one word. And this word Tsuhara, Chouhada, is derived from Shuhada. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but that's, I think, an actual Arabic word, which means the martyrs. So this could also mean long live the martyrs. That would make equal sense. Yeah, because martyrdom is often a factor that drives populations into frenzies. And, you know, if we had a martyr figure in the Fremen, you know, who knows what would happen? Who knows what they'd do?
I think it also makes sense because, like we've been mentioning, the Fedakin, like the Death Commandos, they go into battle like chanting a death chant. So I think it's just like all the fighters of Muad'Dib are prepared to sacrifice their very lives for the ideal of Arrakis, where like they have water and greenery. So I think that's what makes them all martyrs in their eyes, and that's what makes this all the more powerful. It's like each of us are martyrs, and that each of us will like live a long time fighting for Muad'Dib. Uh-huh. And even we die, like, we still live, like, long live, you know? Like, we still, like, congratulate everyone who died for the cause, basically.
Right.
Oh, so, like, we're all part of one entity. So, like, even if a part of us die, the whole is still there.
Yeah, like, the ideal carries on, basically.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now that, basically, Paul has convinced all the Fremen people, at least in his Urg, he suddenly goes a little off script, and Jessica's slightly bothered, and it's like red sirens blaring in her mind, being caught off guard by something that wasn't run past her when they would discuss things. But basically what we see is the swearing of fealty by Stilgar to Paul, and what I imagine almost as, to me, a knighting ceremony. Uh-huh. So we start to see why Jessica like might have been left out of this discussion by Paul. So for Jessica, like I mentioned earlier, she wasn't told about Gurney because I suspect she wasn't emotionally ready to confront the past. And really right here, as we see her reaction to Paul carrying out this rite, it does bring back a lot of emotions for her, and there's a mix of emotions, obviously. So when she sees it, she begins tearing up because she feels some sadness remembering a world where Lita was still alive, you know, her husband, and there's abundance of water. They had like large home, you know, everything was well, like Gurney played a ballast set, a really comfortable life, you know, there's so much more to it that she could like, this thing is like, it's gone. Like she can never return to it. And she just sees that here. It's like an echo almost of like a faded memory. However, at the same time, even though it's just like an echo of a memory, it's also like a reigniting of like, of a continuing tradition here, just like a little bit out of where it used to be, but still like the continuation of the tradition onwards. So she feels some positive emotions because Paul is taking on the mantle of dukedom. He's like officially like, I guess he claims like he, this is my land and stuff, but like this is like a clear show of like duke power. Like he's exercising the duke's responsibilities by bringing another person into like the duke's inner circle, or I don't know what to call it, like officially like giving them power.
A position.
Yeah, officially positioning them. So like just in this first chapter, there's like this first half of the chapter 44, we see Paul claiming his place as duke, his place as Lisa Al-Gaib, on top of his already like well-known place as Paul Muad'Dib, the raider boss of the Fremen, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so yeah, I mean, Paul's just getting a lot of different roles here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean even Jessica is just sinking into old ways a lot, but I mean it's all around her, so can't really blame her.
Yeah, it's kind of nostalgic, brings back memories,
right? So I want to read out the section that Jessica thought was off script, because I think that you guys will have a better understanding if you hear it for yourself. Okay, so it goes, "Repeat after me, Stilgar," Paul said, and he called up the words of investiture as he had heard his own father use them. "I, Stilgar, take this knife from the hands of my duke. I, Stilgar, take this knife from the hands of my duke," Stilgar said, and accepted the milky blade from Paul. "Where my duke commands, there shall I place this blade," Paul said. Stilgar repeated the words, speaking slowly and solemnly. Remembering the source of the rite, Jessica blinked back tears, shook her head. "I know the reasons for this," she thought. "I shouldn't let it stir me. I dedicate this blade to the cause of my duke and the death of his enemies for as long as her blood shall flow," Paul said. Stilgar repeated it after him. "Kiss the blade," Paul ordered. Stilgar obeyed him, then in the Fremen manner, kissed Paul's knife arm. At a nod from Paul, he sheathed the blade and got to his feet.
Yeah, I mean, it really is similar to what English knighting ceremony, now that I hear that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's just so beautiful, honestly, the way that he did it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it feels really traditional and ritualistic, indeed. Yeah, and I mean, if it's off script, at least, I mean, Paul didn't rehearse it maybe with them, but Paul just probably rehearsed it on his own, right? And it's just all the stuff that Jessica and Stilgar don't anticipate. All of this just adds another degree of realism that, you know, for the Fremen to see too, that they haven't scripted the whole thing out.
Yeah, it's raw,
it's really symbolic too, because I mean they've already sort of affirmed their relationship to each other, but this sort of confirms it even more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I think also just like it makes it all the better because now it's just like the way that Paul did it. It brings about like a different, like he claimed that Stilgar was his right arm and stuff, that you need your right arm. But by doing this entire ceremony, he kind of like puts the Atreides way of doing things as like higher than the Fremen way of doing things. So like what they said later on, like they're adopting new ways. Like Paul is showing them new ways of doing things, and he's showing them the Atreides way of doing things. He's showing them the Imperium way of doing things. So in a way, this kind of like cements that there's a new system adopted now, and that there's a new system that the Fremen have to learn and come and grow accustomed to. Like, no longer are they living in their old system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So now we get to my quote of the week, which is, "They could not be more ready. We are taking them at the crest." So this was the thought of Jessica when she was thinking about Paul stirring up the young Fremen and like ready to go into battle, and all the Fremen going like, "Please, Harkonnen blood. We'll wet the sands with the Harkonnen blood." Uh-huh. And Jessica is just like thinking this. And really, it reminds me of that everything has a time and its place, you know? Like, timing and preparation is so important in any plan. Some even say that's like 90% of the actual thing, you know? And I too am a firm believer in being well prepared before heading into something especially difficult. And additionally, Jessica also acknowledges that there is an optimal time for this. So like, there's a time period, you know, so if Paul doesn't capitalize on it now, then the Fremen's fervor will only diminish and slowly sour as the longer it carries out. Kind of like how it kind of soured because they were growing impatient with Paul having not called Stilgar out. So like, I really love it because, again, the whole surfing thing, I was like, man, this is really cool. Like, gotta hit it at the very top for that effect.
Yeah, it's all about the momentum, really. You know, once they start losing momentum, then it's just really hard to bring it back up, right? I mean,
yeah, I love the word momentum. Yeah, mm-hmm. Like in sports games, people talk about momentum. People think it's not real, but like it just feels real. You know, it's momentum.
It's definitely real. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just once you're feeling it, it just keeps going. But you know, once you lose the momentum, once the other team starts scoring points on you or something like that, or the other person, if you play an individual sport, it's just, you know, if you lose the momentum, it's just so hard to pick yourself back up. And in this case too, if Paul loses his momentum with these Fremen, the Fremen are going to start doubting him.
Yep.
Yeah, that's why, like, morale back in the days, like when people would run out into the fields running at each other with like swords and stuff, they would just... Morale would be one of the key factors in winning battles, because the one who's more fired up will take out their enemies a lot easier than those who are just very scared and just not even want to face their enemies.
It just looks scary and intimidating, and that really that sliver of doubt makes you lose, basically.
Yeah, I mean, just having no doubts on the battlefield is just probably the best feeling. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And speaking of momentum, now that it's hit its peak, it seems that the time has truly come for Paul to take back his title and his land. And I'm so excited for the events to come, because this seems to be like a small snowball that formed at the top of a mountain that'll slowly turn into an avalanche, wiping out all the Harkonnens on its way down.
Yeah, I'm so excited to see where this leads, because Paul basically like hinted at this massive plan, like, now we're gonna strike at the Harkonnen's base now that like Rabban is left defenseless. I guess we're like left without reinforcements. So just really hoping to see in the following chapters the crystallization of the plans. We see that Paul's already calling his lieutenants in, like Stilgar, he like delegated it out to Stilgar, you know, so like Stilgar's useful still. And it's really nice to see everything coming together slowly but surely. And now, as we reach the end of the chapter, we get a really, I guess, reflective way to end off this episode. We have Jessica recounting the 3 years, it's been a while, I guess, 3 years she spent on Arrakis. Yeah. So, like, she's adopted many things on her time as Arrakis. We saw part of the adoption, you know, like her adjusting really difficultly to Fremen life. But now, you know, she's made it far. She's the Fremen's Reverend Muller. And she's... thinks that she's changed a lot, and in many ways she has changed a lot, because we saw how much she's changed. But at the same time, there's always a doubt of like, how much has she changed from like before? And that is what kind of scares her a lot, because she's about to come face to face with Gurney, who, if we recall, you know, like got like her like Gurney and Hawal are mad at her because of how kind of like how her past actions on Arrak earlier in this book have kind of reflected poorly upon her, showing her as untrustworthy. You know, it kind of reminds me of the question of like, how much can a person actually change? Because there's so many like debates about like, how much does a person change over time?
Yeah, but I mean, they're in a completely new environment and everything. So hopefully they did work on some changes, or I hope they did change as a person. And although Jessica did act very suspiciously at first, now we know the reasons behind them. And I think that if she's able to explain them to Gurney, he'll understand. Because, I mean, if they do, they'll be able to work out their differences without a fight to the death. And
if Gurney gives her a chance.
Right. And I think it would be very nice if there aren't any more deaths until the big fight between Robin and the Fremen.
Yes.
Right. Cool. And on that note, I believe that concludes the discussion for this episode of the Duna Inter podcast. Make sure to read all the way to the end of chapter 44 and tune in next time when we discuss it. As always, thanks to all of you listeners for being patient with us and being interested in our thoughts. Follow us on Instagram at DoNotEnter, Reddit @DoNotEnter, Twitter @DoNotEnter, and email us at DoNotEnter@gmail.com. That is DUNENOTENTER@gmail.com. Contact us with questions, feedback, or I dare say corrections. Okay, I had to say it this time because I probably made some pronunciation mistakes. So any errors there, please let me know, and I will fix that. Always adding to my vocab. So give us a review on iTunes and Spotify. It only takes a few seconds of your time. So of course you have to make an account and then go to our show and click the 5-star button, because that's the only one that exists, and leave a nice comment or two if you are so inclined. And of course, this serves two purposes. One, it helps get our podcast up the charts so we can get it out to a wider variety of listeners and also spread Dune. And second, on a personal note, it just lets us know that we're doing a good job and motivates us to keep creating content for you guys. So that would be very much appreciated. Otherwise, have a great week, and we will see you all back very soon.
See you guys. Bye, guys.